This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
And our guest tonight is Finn Campbell from Generation Zero. Finn is a master's student at Otago University studying politics. So, but first I'm going to have my number of the week, which is 38 million. And that is there are 38 million individual items of plastic found on the uninhabited Henderson Island in the Pacific Coast, in the Pacific Ocean, sorry. So up to about 12 million tons of plastic enters the world's oceans every year, and that's one ton of plastic every 3 to 10 seconds. Once in the oceans, it can float around for years, even decades, before being swallowed by a bird or a whale. And during that time, it can travel tens of thousands of kilometres, all the while absorbing contaminants from the seawater and concentrating them like a sponge. So when wildlife ingest the plastic, a brew of toxic chemicals can be transferred to the animal's tissues with potentially dangerous consequences and often sometimes fatal for the poor animal involved. So often though, plastic washes up on beaches. So pieces ranging from the size of a grain of sand to large buoys and nets litter the world's beaches. And most of it travels from distant places, having been washed off the decks of a ship or from a storm sewer or waste management facility. So once on the beaches, the plastic items can entangle sea turtles, trap land crabs and cut off access to sand by other beach dwellers. And it just keeps coming. So more than 350 million tons of plastics are manufactured every year. And for that, and that number is only going up at the moment. So this is a problem that's only going to get worse if we don't act fast. And so plastic, the other problem with it, plastic never breaks down. It only kind of breaks up. So sunlight in the ocean waves make plastic brittle with age and fragmenting it to ever smaller pieces. And each piece of plastic, even ever made, still exists somewhere in the world. So plastic is with us to stay and will be in the oceans for millennia to come. It's just a huge issue. So one of the imperatives noted in the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and we talked about those a lot recently, is that we must reduce the amount of plastic in the oceans. And the best way to keep rubbish from washing up on beaches is to reduce our dependence on plastics, especially single-use items like plastic bags. And of course, there's a campaign here in New Zealand to end use of single-use plastic bags, just as a starter, and to make a commitment to seek out alternative methods and materials where possible. So single-use items, so-called disposable items such as razors, cutlery, scoops and toothbrushes are common on even the most remote beaches of the world, including Henderson Island. And this is an area that we can make decisions about the kind of products we use and how to dispose of them, just as individuals. But as we talk about in the show a lot, individual action can only go so far. We need systemic change. So the Oceans Conference at the UN this June will hopefully lay the groundwork for an international strategy to reduce plastic in the oceans. But if we learned anything from international climate strategies is that global environmental agreements take a long time to negotiate and even longer to implement. So we need a bold, decisive action if we're going to save the oceans upon which we all depend and its charismatic islands and wildlife that have captivated us for centuries. So that's my number of week, 38 million pieces of plastic on the uninhabited Henderson's Island beaches. So, Sam, what are your thoughts about this week?
I have been thinking this week about the BMAD. Remember that we started talking about the BMAD about maybe this time last year, about the need for a different sort of education. And in response to, we've talked to several people about the challenges of that, and we're actually doing it. We're actually about halfway through the development stage. At the moment, we're focusing on just identifying the jobs that people that do this new degree will do, and linking that to the graduate profile. So we've got a survey out at the moment, which we're quite keen for people to fill in. We've got in the first survey we did, we identified we had 9 personas. We've added five personas to that. By personas, we're talking about the students that might do the degree, because we're trying to design in a human-centered design approach. We're trying to think really carefully about who's going to do it and then map sort of their pathway through the degree, knowing that they're quite different. So we've got, some, for example, a someone we're calling Piri Purpose, who's got a very clear mission of what they're trying to do, and is looking for a set of skills. And on a sort of related to that, they might be friends, is someone we refer to as Seth Service. They've all got such names like this. Seth Service has got a passion for having an impact and being of service, but they might not necessarily know where they're putting that. So they might be on sort of doing a whole lot of stuff, but it's that sort of service attitude, but not really have identified for themselves where they might have the most impact and how they might go about it. Other people might know that they want to solve a particular problem and already know that they want to solve it through a social enterprise. So we identified those, or that we had identified those, and the people in the first survey agreed that all of those were real people and people for whom this would be a good approach. And we've identified five more. Charlie Challenge, someone who's just out for a challenge, out for an adventure, and, you know, what are we going to do with them? Renee Rebel, someone who believes the system is broken and is quite sort of anti-system, but is trying to search for an alternative solution. Clara Coach, sort of the educator type person, the person that wants to lead in a sort of a helping others kind of mindset. Had quite a few people suggest Ronnie Retiree. We're mostly aiming this at the sort of the school leaver 18-year-old, but we're also seeing that there's a need for people that are retiring. And not necessarily wanting to write their memoirs. That's quite a different sort of role. We sort of got that covered through ordinary capable processes. But people who are like looking to spend their retirement doing something different, quite different from what they had been. And so this is not about putting off doing that until you've learnt those things. But alongside that, how can we make sure we're picking up the appropriate skills to have the biggest impact? And Donnie Disconnected, somebody who is in their sort of early 30s and hasn't really managed to start running yet, and how we can help them. We also identified some anti-pattern personas, people who for whom this degree probably wouldn't work, because we need to design for them both in terms of making sure that they don't sort of stumble into this degree because they might not enjoy it, but also if they do, how do we manage that and find an elegant solution for that? We've got several names for that person. My favorite one is Randy Sociopath. And so what we're doing at the moment, the survey, which we'll put the link to on the Sustainable Lens website, is we are looking for people to think of ideal jobs for all those people. What might Ryan Restart actually do? What might Sarah Style do? Because then we can work backwards from that to say, right, here is a graduate profile that doesn't just deal with that one particular thing, but can deal with all of those different things. Because we've got a bit of a challenge, because it's not the same as designing a degree for a nursing or a lawyer or something, where you can say quite precisely, these are the sets of skills that person needs to have. These are the competencies, that's the things that they know how to do, and the capabilities, that's their behavior, how they use those competencies when it gets difficult, either when it when it all hits the fan or when they get an opportunity that's sort of unexpected and out of the box, how are they going to respond to it? Now, you can specify how we know that here is how a nurse or a lawyer, one of those existing disciplines, should be able to respond to that, but we're doing it as in a post-discipline. These are for disciplines that might not have been invented yet or are hybrid disciplines. So how do we know how those sorts of people should react? So we're trying to just sort of get some understanding and get some people's help on those things. So there's a survey out. I'll put the links on Sustainable Lens as soon as I get home, and we really would appreciate people's help on that.
And when do you plan to have that that course start being taught? Is that next year?
We're aiming for first semester in 2018.
Wow. So all hands on deck.
Yeah, we have to have it into the accreditation processes at sort of mid-July for NZQA approval visits through September and October and so on.
Wow, that's exciting. That is really, really exciting. And now we have a word from our sponsor, Otago Polytechnic.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
So our guest tonight is Finn Campbell from Generation Zero. Finn is a master student at Otago University studying politics. So Generation Zero is a youth-led organisation in New Zealand focused on transitioning society away from its dependency on fossil fuels and combating climate change. And you'll know if you're a regular listener to a show, we've had Generation Zero on several times over the years. So Generation Zero is founded with the central purpose of providing solutions for New Zealand to cut carbon pollution through smarter transport, livable cities, and independence from fossil fuels. And the group believes that young people must be the forefront of tackling climate change, and that young people are the inheritors of humanity's response. Welcome to our show.
Hello, Ben. Hello.
Not too bad. So before we go on to talk about Generation Zero, let's tell you a little bit about yourself. So where were you born, and where did you grow up?
So I was born in Christchurch when my dad was doing his PhD. Quickly moved over to Wagga Wagga in Australia for the first 2 years of my life. Didn't have a great impact on me. Don't really remember it being a young child. And then dad got a job at the University of Otago, and I spent the rest of my life here living in sunny old Dunedin.
So what schools did you go to?
Opo Primary was my first school, right around the corner from the house. Went down to Dunedin North Intermediate, and then shipped my way over to Logan Park High School before somehow ending up at University of Otago. So I think I spent about 2 kilometres of my education radius.
And if anybody doesn't live here, that's a very typical set of schools to go to. For
a very good high school.
Thank you very much. I think so.
All our sons have gone there, so and daughters. And excellent school. And so what got you involved with, what was your passion at school?
Passion at school, I think I had the pretense that I was going to be a dentist. And I think that was, on reflection, that was a terrible idea. But I always, at the same time, wanted to do something right. I don't really kind of know where to put my thumb on the mark and say that's what right is. But I've always felt like if you're going to be doing something, you should be at least trying to make a difference in what's going on around you.
And where did you pick that up from? Is that something you just developed, or is it something that's part of your family, or...?
I feel like it's definitely been a family thing. My dad is a food sociologist, does a lot in sustainability, but at the same time, he's never really pushed that one on me. Maybe it's I haven't quite felt his neck breathing down my neck, telling me you must get into sustainability. It's the only option for the future. I think it's just more of a osmosis, naturally picking up everything from just casual conversations, kind of seeing things going on and just realizing, you know, maybe that's just the way that things should be done.
Do you think he actively tried to avoid it?
I think he actively tried to avoid it. I think he would have been horrified to think that he was forcing his son to do something in particular.
What did you do at school?
A lot of music. Played in the jazz band, played chamber music, did science, you know, biology, chemistry, physics, no English. I dropped that as soon as I could. I thought it was terrible. It was a waste of time. I thought science was the way to go. I regret that one.
Was what's turned into now a bit of a direction in terms of sustainability? Did you know that was going to be there sort of underneath whatever the actual job you did?
I don't think so. I think during my high school years, I didn't really know, didn't really have a clue. Was just kind of traveling through, thinking, you know, gotta do something. But I would sit down at a park bench and look out across the park and say, yeah, this is great, but what am I gonna do? Perpetual existential crises of like, I'm gonna have a job, but where, why, how? I better go to university and find out.
So what did you do when you first got to university?
I signed myself up for a double major, Bachelor of Applied Science in Energy Management and Environmental Management. I thought my pathway to success was becoming an electrical engineer, someone who's very in tune with the physics, what was going on with renewable energy systems, with conventional energy systems, fossil fuels, understanding, you know, doing the geography parts of it, thinking this was absolutely the pathway to go. I'm gonna change the industry from within. And then I realized that, holy moly, I do not like the maths. I was probably, if I came out and followed that degree through, I would have been a fairly average engineer. And I thought, the world doesn't need another average engineer telling people what to do. And then I realized it wasn't changing people through action. It was changing people through actually being the positive change I wanted without becoming an engineer. That politics and people were really the problem that we're facing these days. We've got great wind turbines, we've got great solar panels, not so great hydroelectric, but still not burning fossil fuels to use them. And that, yeah.
Did you have like a moment of epiphany that the problem's not technical but people?
I think getting into politics, studying politics at the University of Otago, thinking, holy moly, this is great. First of all, I was really into it, really passionate. I always thought reading the newspaper in the morning and get really excited about what you're reading about was just a hobby, and for maybe it still is. But kind of clicking and going, oh wait, politicians are the ones who are kind of telling people how to do things. Policymakers, planners, all these people are having such a great influence on how we actually use what we've got. So I'm not gonna try and tackle what we've got. I think what we've got is great. But how we're using it, on the other hand, is where the problem lies, in my mind.
So was that something? So what you said, you started studying politics. So when did you? When was that? Was that like you at the end of first year went, oh?
I wish it was the end of first year. I was a little bit stubborn headed. I went and studied for 2 years, doing my Bachelor of Applied Science, and thought I need a break. And went and worked in a hospitality job for about a year, and went backpacking around Europe. One of those classic. I'm just going to escape from all my problems, and then once I maybe find some energy for energy management again, and then give it a second shot. Came back, gave it a second shot, and went, oh man, no, man, there's something's not going right here. But at the same time, I was picking up a politics paper, and I was just killing it, loving it. Having a great time. Such a great time. I was kind of skipping out on my energy management work that I should have been doing.
Is it something fundamental about that sort of energy management approach, or is it you, or a combination of those two?
I think energy management is excellent if you're going to end up working in the field, or maybe telling people how to work from within the industry. But I think for me personally, I think I look at a problem, and for me, it's never the numbers game. It's the message we have is fantastic. It's such an easy sell. How come we're not selling it? And so it's always been a messaging. Where's it going wrong? How's it getting lost out there? And what on earth can we do to actually bring it back into the forefront?
So you should have been listening more to those English teachers and drama teachers at Logan High.
Yes. I think, well, I mean, I'm sure the English teacher would have had a few words to say about my blog post writing. Still work in progress.
So you got yourself a politics degree?
Yes.
Did the politics deliver on what you sort of changed career on the basis of the first paper that you loved? Did the rest of the degree deliver on what you hoped for?
If you say maybe from where you went from the start in a nursing degree or a law degree, sending you directly into a career of law or nursing, a politics degree, I think I got pretty tired of people asking me if I want to be an MP. but I think it's certainly an interesting way to study how things are happening. It's a study of people in a very strict environment. It's, you know, if you talk to a political scientist, political theorist, I'm sure they'd argue and say politics is very bored, and I've had to write many an essay on all that. But you say politics and the governance and the systems and the understanding of power relationships and how they form, why they're there in the first place. You have a different lens through which you approach things. You realize you can be a sort of normal citizen, but you've got an extra pair of glasses that suddenly see through all the nonsense that's going on, and you go, why do we have to accept this? Why do we have to accept that? Why is this person even here? What are they doing? They're monstrous. They really don't care. What are they in it for? Is it just a meal ticket for these politicians? I don't know.
And why is it turned into such a game? Or theatre, perhaps?
This is one of my struggles. this could leave me leaving this interview, going home and just staring at the ceiling for a long time. I think, how does it end up like this? People vote for their instinct. People vote for what makes most sense to them. They vote for you know, their interest, and you can't fault them for that. You can't fault someone for voting for something they believe in, because it's just sensible to stand up and say, I should take care of myself because that's in my best interest. And so you sit there and like, why is that your best interest? What's been teaching you? Who's been teaching you? What's been involved in your life to make you think that is your version of the optimal outcome? And that's the problem. And then you get politicians that reflect that behavior. They reflect. They're merely a mirror of their constituents. People who are just voting for self-interest. But
is politics broken?
No, you can't break politics unless you somehow inject a whole lot of money into it so it's represented by corporations. But so democracy, you've just kind of got to accept it at face value that it's everyone gets a say.
There seems to be a lunatic in the White House.
Yes, I hold out hope that ultimately there will be a good outcome from that. He's a terrible person, but what he might do for the American political system might be good if he goes, and goes quickly.
Because they'll say, let's not let that happen again.
Let's figure out what went so horribly wrong.
But in the meantime, he appears to have fallen out with Europe.
Yes.
Pulling out of Paris.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I was reading the articles just today thinking Trump might pull out. Trump might pull out. Trump says he's going to pull out. Trump has pulled out. And I'm like, oh, crap. Oh, no. I guess that's the problem with international agreements. International agreements always pretend to be some sort of higher authority upon states, and you know, look, we've got the UN now we're going to tell you what to do. No, every international agreement is just a pretend. People buy into it because they can or they want to, and so they've got to think that there's a reason why people should get involved. And so if the US pulls out and they think it's not their interest, you can't do much to stop them.
If when they do pull out, what's the message for New Zealand politicians, do you think? Should we pull out too?
No, I don't think we should pull out. I think when you've got the US pulling out, yeah, that's definitely not good. But the fact that China and India are still committing to it, and they're the sort of economies that you've really got to worry about with that sort of transition, they're the ones who are often brought to the negotiating table and think, why should we commit to this? You've had a life of luxury, United States, New Zealand, Australia, Great Britain. Why should we not follow in your footsteps? We have every right to industrialize, we have every right to develop, and the fact that they're buying into this and continuing to say, like, we're gonna move forward is very optimistic. I think it's a great sense of possibility that these countries are still continuing to think that this is something worth following.
So you finished your degree?
Yes.
And then went back for another one?
Back for a master's.
Must be in the blood.
Oh, it's terrible. I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I think I've made one smart call, and that the Masters of Politics has only been going for its second year now. I thought, I don't really feel like being a guinea pig. So I worked in hospitality again, kind of escaped, I think, from when I started university in 2011 until last year. I'd spent quite a long time in and out, and I thought, time to just have a wee rest. Stop thinking about it so much academically. Do my volunteering, do my activism, but also take a break, recharge, give the batteries a chance to get going again.
So, eventually, you got back?
Yes.
And you've decided to do what?
For my master's of politics. Yeah. Factors of water scarcity in conflict in the, well, what will be the Middle East, it will be my case studies, as part of my dissertation, but it's a part taught, part dissertation master's, so I still have my theoretical theory of politics paper, and then I have comparative regional conflicts, so I still have to kind of learn the whole suite of things expected to be, you know, come out as an MPOL student.
Did you say as a driver of conflict, water scarcity?
Yeah. Well, as a factor, I think where when you read political journals talking about climate change and conflict, the narrative is not always the same. And I think I get a bit bemused by that, but I guess all my friends from Generation Zero and sustainability minded people go, of course climate change is related and scarcity. How could you not think that? And because there's water scarcity, of course there's conflict, you know. Water scarcity runs into crops, disease, all these sorts of other factors. Of course there's a relationship, and I'm sitting there going, Okay, I'll have a look at that. I want to pull that apart and really look at what the academics have been writing and realize that some people say that it's not a factor, that water scarcity is not good. There's no doubt about that. I don't think anyone stands up and says water scarcity is fine, don't worry about it. But everyone seems to be saying it's either good governance or bad governance. You can have plenty of drought, and where's the war? Where's the conflict? Where's the starvation? What's going on here? And then other places which have got plenty of water and far more conflict. So with something as complex and multidimensional as this, you've got to try and figure out some cases where you can really pull them apart, look at water scarcity and go, all right, this is where it's going wrong. This is a direct factor in conflict. And that's what I'm looking for. Hopefully I'll find something like that, but I guess for the sake of academic integrity, I can't just say there's going to be water scarcity, let's go for it.
I mean, presumably, just to jump ahead to a thesis you haven't written yet, you're going to be concluding something about complexity, systems thinking, wicked problems.
Mm-hmm.
It's all that mushy stuff put together.
Yeah.
Because you already know it's not as simple as yes or no.
Yes.
Do we... You know, through that politics degree, is things like complexity, system thinking, wicked problems, are they a thing that we're actively teaching people?
No, I don't think so. Not at any level. I think you'd only really start approaching that, at least in a political sense, even though you do lots of sort of conflict analysis. It's still very much like, oh, you've got this factor, so X is going to happen. There's no doubt about it. And you think, well, you know, we need more information. We need a better understanding of what's going on here. And then you realize as soon as you start getting more and more and more and more complex, that there's so many factors going on that you can't look at one thing and say this is going to be it. You can only create building blocks which you can contribute towards something, but you can never quite say this is exactly what's going to happen. I mean, in politics, we hear a lot about political theory, trying to predict conflict, predict why states act. And all of it's just useless forecasting at the end of it. They have some sort of pretense that they're going to know exactly when the next conflict's going to rise up, when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, who's going to be involved. And you go, that's a bit rubbish.
Does political theory cope with that kind of complexity?
No. No, it doesn't. No, not at all. It likes to think it does, but when you start applying it, you realize you almost have to become a complete specialist in one country or one conflict to really know such of the information that's going into it that you can't. You know, you're a specialist in the Middle East, and even then they specialize in Syria, and then they've got no understanding of what's going on necessarily in the Pacific Islands, and you've got someone else going in there, and it's just, yeah, it's interesting stuff. There's no doubt, but as soon as you start getting into it, you realize you can't really make proper claims, assessments, or forecasts without understanding the information. It just gets so complicated so bloody quickly.
So somewhere along the line, you decided not just to study stuff, but to do something about it?
I think so, yes.
What led to that?
I think that itch was going on in the back of my head, going, "You've got an obligation to be the change that you want to see going on. If you want a future, why not fight for it?" I mean, I can't just expect to sit at my computer all day, wonderfully in Blissland, playing on my computer, reading news articles, and then expect someone around the street corner to show up and show me what electric cars are like, what a nice utopia world we have amongst us. I realized, oh crap, that's going to have to be me, or that's going to have to be people like me, who want to see the change going on and realize that, you know, maybe the political process doesn't involve waiting every 3 years for an election to come along. And so I found out 3 years ago that the group Generation Zero, which I just heard about, was doing enrollments on campus for students, and that main goal there was actually to be completely not involved in the politics of it. Whether you're a national voter, a Labour voter, Green, New Zealand First, ACT. No, we didn't care. We said, if you're a young person, you should be participating. We held events. We had a gig down at Refuel where the door entrance fee was signing up and proving that you're on the electoral roll. And if you weren't on the electoral roll, we had a form right there. And I remember I got my right hand onto TV3. It was in some back shot somewhere, writing on a form.
So give us Generation Zero 101.
Generation Zero 101. Whew. Okay, so nationwide organization, wonderful, with a sort of governance going on at a national level. And then you have teams based in every city, and they're relatively autonomous. I'm the convener for Generation Zero Dunedin at the moment, or co-convener with another person. And we do what works for Dunedin. I think we don't have a lot of people coming from national level team and saying, Dunedin needs to be doing this because this is the most important thing for all in New Zealand. We kind of sit there as our group and we go, what's going on, Dunedin? What's actually the problems? Why is South Dunedin a big issue? What's going on with cycleways? What's going on with housing? Why are these things not being addressed? And how can we as a group best target them? I guess we felt like being a regional based organization and contributing to a national cause, sometimes you spend a lot of time feeling like you got a megaphone held up to nothing. You're just shouting your message out there and you're thinking it's just bouncing off the walls, surely no one's picking this up. So when you talk at a regional, local level, you find yourself sitting in council chambers, hearing councillors talk, you go to resource consent applications, you go to we've gone to the second generation district plan, we've made submissions on that, and we find that you get immediate feedback and an understanding of what impact you're having at that level specifically. And then through a sort of combined effort through all these teams doing this in Dunedin, Wellington, Christchurch, Hamilton, Auckland, you find that all these major centres in New Zealand are really like slowly but surely having sustainability and Generation Zero's vision embedded into what's going on, so that cycleways are getting passed, because there's been a record amount of submissions coming through one of our online forms. I think Auckland team has the pride of having one of the largest submissions ever held for a consent application for the SkyPath. They adopted it. Their SkyPath wasn't their plan, but they found out and thought, wow, this is bloody excellent. How can we best make this happen? And so they wrote an online form, basically got a couple of tick boxes for people to come in on their website and just say, yes, we want this. And I think they got 10,000 submissions, which I think for anything of its kind, it was the largest. And then councillors found out about it, said, yes, that's all right. They tried to do it again and counted it as one. So we had hundreds of people would come in, thousands, whatever. They would say, "Oh, that's the Generation Zero submission." And we're like, "Oh crap, we're gonna have to change our form options because otherwise they're gonna, you know, a one person vote at a council policy submission doesn't really count for much." So we had to change all the forms so everyone gets their own name put on it, and we just adjusted the system slightly and carried on writing a whole boatload of those.
is influencing the people who are sitting around the tables making decisions, is that the best way of making change?
I think it's one of the ways. That's how I feel. I think there is a fairly comprehensive sustainability / climate change or transport movement going on in New Zealand, or I can speak for Dunedin and say Dunedin, I think, is going to be a very interesting one, and trying to figure out what piece of the pie you make up. Everyone's sort of contributing in some particular area. You've got Students for Environmental Action doing environmental focuses on campus. You've got Spokes who do cycle-related things, and you think, how can we best fit into this piece of the puzzle so that we're not doubling up, we're not expending unnecessary energy doing something that's been done before. And the councillors, planners, whenever they hear us come along, they're almost like, say, please come back for more, we need to hear what you people actually want to say. It's like finding out that you're the youngest person in the room by half, and then it's like amazing if someone under 30 shows up and you're 24.
Is that because, not just because you're turning up and you're young, but because you're turning up and being constructive?
Yes.
Because you make a point of not just having a submission saying we don't like this, but actually, you know, putting forward quite detailed proposals and things.
Well, I think we have some people in Dunedin who have background, have done the Masters of Planning, everything. So they've basically got the credentials enough to become a planner. We've had people who are law students, and so they have a great understanding of the law and what's actually helpful or not. And so we get down, we figure out what's going on with the Resource Management Act. If it's a Resource Management Act application, we try and figure out what's going on with the second generation district plan. We try and figure out what are they actually trying to do here. And sometimes we've gone, oh man, we're just scratching our heads. What on earth are they actually trying to do here? And so we went along to the hearing, and the lady before us went, and she didn't like wind turbines. Sitting there, biting my teeth, trying not to say anything, and she went on a big tirade. But democracy is democracy, and she attacked wind turbines. And I went, oh crap, why is this person? And she just basically abused the planet. Said, you know, you need to do this. You must never let these things happen in our city. Never again. This is terrible. They're windy, noisy, whatever, you name it. She's got something wrong to say with it. And the look on the planet was just like, what have I done to deserve this? And we didn't know what to do. And we said, What would it mean to have wind turbines here? Why do you want to do this? And she went, it's reason X, reason Y, reason Z. So, and we said, what would it take to change the policy? Because we don't know how to write these things. We're not a planner. We have no idea what to do. What do we do? Can we, what do we ask for? And they go, oh, you'd want to ask for this. And we go, yes, please, can we have that option there? And we're wind turbines. And we got a mention from one of the other councils being like, oh, that was one of the most productive things we've heard from one of these sessions, basically because the planners know exactly what they're doing, but they've got to write a plan that is the will of the people. And the people are showing up and abusing them. They don't write very much, and what they write isn't very helpful. And so we sit there and go, we want to be helpful. What can we do? And how do we say it? Because as soon as you show up to a council meeting, you show up to anything, and you say, I would like this, they can do something about it. But they can't write a vision for the city as much as they would like to.
You've clearly identified a point of leverage there that's actually making a difference, which is what you said you wanted to do.
Yeah.
Do we also need to take the community along with us?
I'd love to see the community come along for a ride. That'd be great. But, I mean, we are busy.
I mean, you don't look like a hippie, but...
No, that's probably a
trick. Do you get accused of being one?
Lee Vandevis described me as a climate change fundamentalist. That was wonderful. It was great fun. I had a great chuckle. I thought it was the best thing ever. I thought, if only he knew what I looked like. I went along to a meeting a couple of weeks after he'd said that, and he couldn't spot me in the crowd. He had no idea who he was talking to, obviously, when he was referring to Generation Zero, the climate change fundamentalist who want nothing but to ruin his life. Could you get the community along for the ride? Yes, but I think this touches on another issue for me, which is almost not a great big grand issue, but it's like, how do we redemocratize politics for young people? I've thought about that, and it's just like, well, what steps does it actually take to change the political system the way that it is, so that engagement is there, engagement is convenient, or that people just see the virtue or the value in stepping up, putting your hand up and saying, maybe I want this. There's a UN youth meeting happening on in a couple of weeks, and they want to talk about how to get young people involved in politics and to make sure they do their bit. And I was tempted to go along, but I realized I'm so busy and full of exams and essays, I got no time for it. And then I sort of found out what they wanted to do. And it's basically trying to get them involved at a national level of politics. And I thought, that's not just it. Stamping your meal ticket every 3 years and saying you participated is not what politics really is. It's showing up to the meetings, actually being a consistent voice, actually saying, what can I do at this meeting to embed sustainability into everything that's being said? If the DCC has, I don't know, every policy document coming out for the next 10 years, and some group of young, plucky young people have made sure that everything says sustainability in some way or another, they can't really avoid it. They don't really have a choice at that point. They've got to do what the document says.
So you're calling yourself Generation Zero. Is there a generational divide?
Sometimes it feels like it. And then sometimes our biggest supporters are your sort of retirees. It's unfair, I think, to categorize everyone as, oh, you're old and you've got your foot out the door and you simply don't care. I think that's not true. I think there are a lot of people who see what we do, and some of our biggest supporters are from some of the older communities who think they've got a good message and we can certainly give them our resources to help them achieve what they want to do. Is there a bit of a divide? Maybe, but in our advantage. For some reason, people think that when a young person shows up, a lot of the time that it's like you don't have to display all these sorts of credentials. You don't have to wear your badge on your shoulder that says, oh, look, you're a planner. You should know exactly what I'm talking about. You're a lawyer. You need to go on. We've got all these people who basically have these same sorts of credentials, maybe certainly not the industry experience that some of you would desire.
I mean, I think it could be part of that, as you say, you're busy.
Yeah.
And so somebody that's, we know you're busy.
Yeah.
Or you could just be having a party.
Yeah.
Yet you're deciding to put your time into this. People give you some respect for that, I think.
Yeah. It seems to be the case.
Generation Zero makes a point of being apolitical, politically active, but not aligning with any party.
We try to avoid it.
Despite the fact there's some obvious connections to one side of, if we put it on a left-right continuum?
Up until now, yes. Since we released our Zero Carbon Act, actually there's been a lot of buy-in from National, which has been humbling, surprising, sort of stunning me. Like, what on earth are these guys wanting to do stepping foot near this document? And I think it's a really promising sign that maybe this change is going to happen. Like, is this really going to be the partisan issue it's always been? Or is the shift happening? What's going on? Struggling. Don't know what to do. There's no one to attack.
So tell us what the Zero Carbon Act thing is.
It's a piece of climate change legislation modelled off the UK Climate Change Act, which was implemented in 2008 under David Cameron's Tory government. It passed almost unanimously and has been quite responsible for UK's positive climate change impacts it has on its own carbon emissions and sort of transport infrastructure. And so we took the guts of the document, kind of ripped it apart. Not me personally, I don't pretend to have any law experience, but we've got enough policy wonks out there to basically write a document for New Zealand that suits New Zealand's climate change needs. And so we're trying to pass that at the moment. I think we have 3,500 signatories signing on. We've got quite a few people who are buying in, who want to say that this is something that's important. We've had MPs from both across the board saying that this is good. We're getting youth party buy-in. People all over the place are saying maybe climate change is not going to be an election issue.
You need to broker.
Yeah.
That it's okay that it doesn't. The first party that comes out and says we support it, you don't want the other party to knee-jerk reaction and say that means I don't.
Think we've spent a lot of time talking to everyone, and everyone kind of knows it's there. Some people like it more than others. Parties maybe like it more than others, but also individuals within parties see it as something. So maybe we don't need a complete party buy-in from one or the other. Some people might jump across and say, look, this is a conscious vote for me. I want this to happen, and I can see this happen.
Has Generation Zero either locally or nationally worked out what you're going to do running up to the election this year?
Locally, I don't want to quite say it because it's always got a bad word, but lobby. People always have negative connotations about what lobbying is because you think money, guns, tobacco, alcohol, and drug companies, and then you go, wait, why can't we have nice green sustainability lobby too? We don't have much money, but at least we're cool. So I think Generation Zero Dunedin, we're going to, this year leading up to the election, we're going to spend a lot of time doing our standard meat and bread policy work with the council, but we're going to be targeting a lot of groups, saying we want you to come in and buy in with us and say that this is something you need. That sustainability, climate change, all these things requires a framework to work within. If a government's not doing it, you're kind of swimming against the tide. If the government's not providing you the framework to do it, how can we expect the local councils to enact it? They've always sort of expressed that they're sort of hamstrung by what national governance wants. And so if we can get them to buy in, we had the Greater Wellington Regional Council Chair saying he wants to get all the local councils together and lobby on the behalf of the Zero Carbon Act. And I thought, well, I guess I better ring up Dave Carl then. I haven't done that just yet. But that's something we want to do. We want to make it an issue such that we're come next election, when it's happened, end of September, and we've got a new sitting government, that they can see that this is something that young people, old people, middle-aged people from all across the board see this as a vital part of our future, and that some Band-Aid policy coming out from one side is not quite going to cut it.
You said it probably, climate change, that is, probably won't be an election issue, but it looks like water might be.
Yes. So you got trouble trying to segue into it. I think when you try and bring the conversation to climate change, people sometimes just shut off. They go, well, I mean, why this? We've got housing. Climate change, we can think about that one next year. we got to figure out all these highways. Climate change can happen next. And so it's always on the agenda, but it's always being deferred till next time.
I've always thought it was a shame that we couldn't say climate change starts next Tuesday.
Yeah.
4 o'clock.
Yeah, come on, let's do something about it. So I guess
somebody said that wouldn't work because you would get to that time and you'd have people saying, see, didn't happen.
Yeah, and you go, oh, okay, well, I guess,
maybe it starts next year.
Yeah, you got me. Well, gotcha.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
I had to think about this one. Being sustainable is acting or providing an action which you know, without a doubt, is going to be able to carry on in its form. It might adjust with the times, but a sustainable action is something that will just carry on no matter what. I think that's how I thought about it. I don't want to go into some deep, I can go on forever, I think, about what sustainability is. But for me, that's if you're being sustainable, you're doing something where you know it's going to carry on.
Some people are talking about sustainability not being enough anymore, that we need to be regenerative. You know, we've wrecked the place enough that just stopping and carrying on like we are, it wouldn't be enough.
Yeah.
Do you think, you know, do we have to not just slow the ship but turn it around?
I feel like, yeah, there's something actually that will need to be done if we're not doing something now. I think if it'd been 1990 and we'd sat down and said, all right guys, let's stop it now, no problem, maybe that would have been the case. But now we're sitting here thinking we're gonna have to give up something unless something else changes. We can't predict what's going on here.
We've been using that line that it's not a lesser life, it's a better life. Do you think we can still pull that off?
We'd have to change what is normal. We would absolutely have to change what is normal. And I guess that's part of what I'm trying to do, is trying to get people to think about what's normal, what's acceptable. Everything that's going on at the moment, sustainability, whatever. Your life has been dictated by politicians, policies, personal choices, influence of your parents, and all these things. These are just normal. And right now this normal should not carry on. Can you live a happy life? Yes, I think so. But what we've got to accept now is that why are plastic bags still coming out of supermarkets? Why is there a terrible bus transport system in Dunedin? Why is it every time a cycleway gets put in, people put up on their arms and say these are terrible things? Something's got to change for what normal is, and people have got to appreciate that normal is just kind of accepting a status quo of what's going on and not being an influence in the change that you want. Accepting normality is accepting that someone else is probably going to make a decision for you.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Last couple of years? Interesting to think that far back. I almost feel like I've had setbacks with last election. Greens lost a proportion of the vote. Turns out if you enroll youth at the university, you get a lot more conservative ones coming down from Auckland. So maybe next time we're not going to enroll so many people on campus. Immediate success, just recently the Dunedin City Council is finally putting funding back into environmental strategy. They gave options on their annual plan submission and said, do you want $150,000 or $200,000? And we went, more. And we got enough people to say more that they ended up giving us, not Generation Zero specifically, but the environmental strategy, Te Aotearoa, $250,000. So through complaining and saying that maybe that's not enough, we managed to get a 25% increase on the funding for environmental strategy.
You've hinted at the answer to this several times. In fact, you've been explicit once. But I'll ask it anyway. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes.
Why?
Someone's got to be active. Would I be a traditional activist? No, not really. I haven't done many protests. I haven't showed up to many marches. I think one I did was in 2003 against the war in Iraq. That was about it as far as marches and your traditional forms of activism going. I think my form of activism, if you can call it that, is pretending you're a grey old man in a council chamber and pretending you're like them and thinking like them, and then suddenly going, wham, here's some sustainability for you.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. How do you describe your superpower? What is it that you're bringing to the good fight, other than pretending you're a grey old man and then going, wham, I'm not letting you have that?
I wouldn't call it shape-shifting then, would it? I guess it's all about people and communication. What I try and bring to the table is participation. My objective is making democracy easy. And when you make democracy easy, you make input your idea of what democracy is easy. And for hopefully most conscious breathing people who want to see a future that does include some form of climate change sustainability response in your daily life, and changing what we currently have, which is no good, to something excellent, which we can keep on doing.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Well, we've got the Zero Carbon Act. That's certainly going to be a big challenge. One of my personal challenges will be ensuring that this sort of movement just doesn't die off when it's happening because you need it. I don't want this to be a reactionary movement that says we're going to be here because there's a problem, and as soon as this giant pressing issue goes away and we think the solution's gone, we're just going to sit down on the couch and ignore it. I want to see that people take a more proactive, continuing approach to how they live their lives, but also their participation in everything. We got this way because we didn't act until we needed to, so let's not get it so we're acting until we need to next time, for whatever that may be.
Okay, very quickly, because we've almost run out of time.
Not a problem.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would it be?
Oh, just change the normal. Change what is normal.
And advice for listeners?
Participate. That's the best part.
Fantastic, and we're going to leave it there. So you're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio on 105.4 FM. This show is recorded on the 1st of June 2017. Our guests were Finn Campbell, your host, Professor Samuel Mann, and me, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows at sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.